You know, I always wish I wouldn't have to prepare less. I could just come and talk to you. Wouldn't be have to be so organized. But when you come to a class, you got to organize your thoughts, right? And so I figured, well, I'll get up early this morning and finish up. And I did. I got up at 6, and I said, well, I better look at my clock, you know, because time does get away for you. And it was 7 o'clock. And when it was, you know, just it started, I thought, so not enough time to do everything. I'm sort of being, tormented is not the right word, agitated, okay, with some questions about Christianity that are deeper or wider, I don't know what dimension you look at here, than we usually look at. And we did a little bit of that out of our European visit with art and architecture last week. And so I've got a couple lessons here. I'm going to do one I did this morning first, and that may be a whole lesson itself. I don't know. And then we'll do the one that I was really going to do if I didn't do the one I was going to do first. All right. So, and so I have another week yet. Then I'm off for a week because we're going to take our last hurrah to Branson. Then Larry's going to teach. And then we're back on Labor Day weekend. We'll be back here. So I have two more weeks kind of before I want to get back to our covenantal study on the Bible as a contract. So I guess I have two more weeks kind of to finish this up. And the original stimulation to this idea came out of a book I read, and some of us that are in the Friday morning group have, we looked through the book. I'm not sure we read it, but we looked through the book called Victor of Reason by Rodney Stark. And there's a lot of problems in the book. I mean, I don't know whether when he wrote the book that he was a believer or not. I think from what I have read since then, I'd always like to know these people, if I can, if they're believers, because they're perspectives obviously change if they do, and they may say things differently. But he writes in some ways that really vex a Christian, and especially our kind of Christians, where we have a high view of Scripture. And for me, he doesn't have quite enough high view of Scripture. But outside of that, and a couple other little things, I really think he makes some points that are really stimulating. And so that's why I want to talk to you about it. And I would never talk to a congregation like our church this way, but I think I'd talk to you about it in class because you know what I'm doing and you know me, and I wouldn't lead you astray on purpose because this needs some background. All right. Now, we started that last week with art and architecture out of Europe. So when we do this stuff, we talk about why only in the West was there success that we have seen in humanity? Why only in the West? And the answer to that question is Christianity. But that leaves a lot of questions open. And that's what I'm going to start with, this question of what is Christianity? And I could do this at the end of my lesson or the beginning of the lesson. So I'm going to do it at the beginning of the lesson, and then we'll see how it goes. What is Christian is the question. The question that always comes up when we talk about Christianity is, how can we talk about any kind of Christianity unless we include the saving gospel? Is that what you think? Okay, it's just generally how we think. Christianity has to do with the gospel. Therefore, if saving gospel is not in Christianity, and I'll put that in quotes, I guess, if it's saving gospel is not in Christianity, then it is not Christianity. If something purports to be Christian but excludes the true gospel, it is an apostate religion, a distorted Christianity, really no Christianity at all. Now, that's where we start. But I'm not sure that's quite right. But that's where we start, and that's how we usually end, and there's no more discussion after that point. And then when I come up with my class, like last week about art, then we're vexed by that. And I don't want us to be vexed by this. I don't want us to be confused by what is Christian either. So that's what I'm going to try to explain to you. And by the way, a lot of times we say, and Gil has said it himself, say, well, when I'm talking about Christianity, I'm talking about Christendom, you know, sort of the aura of Christianity over, you know, culture or whatever. You know, that's kind of what I want to explain. It goes on to explain it. I'm going to try to explain it to you this morning. All right, read that one. Okay, to be clear, if saving Christianity does not include the gospel, the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, then that aspect of Christianity has been corrupted. You can't have saving, I'm going to add saving Christianity without having the death, burial, resurrection included in it. So we're okay with that. We're all on board with that. I think we all agree with that. But here's where we got to be careful. But there are other beliefs that are unique to Christianity besides the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ in Christianity. Now, facts that are true in Christianity that we believe, okay, facts that are true, but believing them to be true does not save anyone. So there's other things we can know about life, about what we believe as Christians. People believe, but that doesn't save them. There are other beliefs that are unique, but there are other beliefs that are unique in Christianity, facts that are true, but believing them to be true does not save anyone, does not bring righteousness to the soul. Yet, it must be considered part of Christianity. So, for example, take the act of creation as recorded in the Genesis. Is that a biblical truth? Yes. It's in the book of Genesis. It has to be biblical truth because it's in the Bible. Do Christians believe the book of Genesis? Yes. Well, we hope they do, although we wonder over here on the Covenantals. Yeah, we do believe it. So there are a lot of things that can be accepted as Christian without being a Christian. Okay, remember, getting ahead of my story here. Yet it must be considered part of Christianity, the story of Genesis, the record of our creation, of the world. So many people believe that God created the heavens and the earth, and they are not saved. Do you agree with that? Yeah, a lot of people believe that. I mean, the Catholic believes that person, that. They have not believed, but they have not believed in the saving gospel to be saved. So we can have people that believe in the creation story as the real bona fide event and work of God, but they are not necessarily saved. And I might even reverse that around and say people that are saved may not believe in the creation story either, but that's kind of risky to me, and that's where we are with covenantal theology a little bit, because they bifurcate this stuff, and that's not important, and this is not important. This is, so, I mean, I want to do that. So we could list many things that unbelievers may believe to be true and even act on that truth, but it's not saved. So we have people that marry. They marry. Why do they marry? But it's the right thing to do. Right? And if they live together, it's not the right thing to do, even though they do it. Said, you know, like we had a neighbor told my wife, after they lived together and they got married, so, you know, without out of the blue, she says to my wife, says, no, we are married. I'm not living in sin anymore. We're not believers. But, you know, there's this sense of what, so marriage is some of those is one of those things. Living a moral life. You don't steal your property. I mean, you have unbelievers living to each, next to each other. They don't steal each other's lawnmowers. You know, you have this going on, and they watch for their, you know, properties for theft when they're gone or whatever. So they work to provide for the families, the good breadwinners. You know, that, like I say, they mow their lawn. They wash the windows, you know. So the list could describe most of our activities, like let's say Lincoln, Nebraska, most of our activities that have moral implications. These impulses, these duties, obligations are felt. And you maybe don't know this, but they're all given in the Bible. No man sits on a rock and comes up with, thou shalt not steal. If you leave the man alone sitting on the rock, he says, I will steal. So when he's told not to steal, he understands that he doesn't steal. Somehow that's built into his moral code. It's traceable to some source. Why does he not steal? Hence we have the Christian thing. You know, Christian thing to do, sometimes we saw it, say it. This only acknowledges the source of the moral code, the source of the moral code or conduct, which is the Bible. Now, again, people marry and don't steal, and they may not even think that this stuff comes from the Bible. But they don't do these things, but we know because the Bible says that God is not pleased with, you know, adverse activities. So to these activities, we say that they are Christian-like. They act like Christians. Christian-like activities, not because they are saved or will be saved, or will those acts saved will save them, but because they come from the teaching of Christianity. Now, you might not, again, think about this, say, well, thou shalt not steal, they say that in King James English. We know that comes from the Bible, but if it didn't say it in the Bible, we'd know it anyway. Not really. Probably not. So the moral code we live under comes from the Bible. At least that's the only place that I know of, that you know of, can you show me that it's written in precept form that you can say, thou shalt not steal. Only in the Bible do you find that. And if you find it somewhere else, it's because somebody copied it out of the Bible. So now, when I talk about Christianity, I got to also include what we call Judeo-Christian. So we don't want to exclude the Jews from this because the Judeo-Christian Bible is what we work with, because the Genesis is in the Jewish Bible, the Old Testament. Okay, so we have then the unique teachings of the Bible. Now, Christians, like that? Christians? We have Christians. Of course, we must be careful how we use the term Christian. And if I listen to you talk about examining our speech, we generally are careful of what we say. We never assume, never say never. We generally don't assume too much because we say, well, so-and-so is a Christian, and we are likely to follow up. This group will probably follow up with a Christian that reveals a saved person or one just living in a certain moral way. So you can have a Christian lives in a certain moral way, but then you have a Christian who lives not only in a moral way, but also is saved by grace. All right? So that's why I use the word Christians. Now, I know we don't talk that way, but you understand. Now, to the point of my lesson, which we have not had yet, which I could have already had by now, but I didn't. I did it first. Now, the point of our lesson, if I say that in the West, now I'm talking about European West, including America eventually, it was Christianity that made Europe prosper. You understand that saving faith did not make the West prosper. Although there can be a point made here because there were many of them that were saved. But saving faith didn't make the West prosper. But that people who believed the Bible, saved or not, were motivated by Christian virtues in ways that no other belief system ever could. And we said yesterday, Christianity, spelled wrong, has a consequential God. No other religion has a God that you can define, or that he makes any difference. Or you know you can offend him, but you don't know what pleases him. So without Christianity, the West would still be living in caves and chasing their sheep and goats looking for water holes. Now you might think that's not true. But when we were in Israel in 1983, when I looked out over the desert land and I saw these Bedouin tents made out of sheep goat skins, the only difference between that look and the look that I would have had if I was looking at Abraham's tent, only difference, well, there were actually two. One, it had a TV antenna on it and a Mercedes in front of it. But the rest of it was the same as if Abraham walked out. Why is that? Don't answer that question. As these Western innovators, talking about the West now, as these Western innovators, righteous and forgiven their sins? Perhaps, but not necessarily, probably not in the percentages. But Christian America produced the climate for the giants of Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, Microsoft, Steve Jobs, Apple, Warren Buffett, probably less because it's more or less an empire building, Jeff Bezos, Amazon guy, to produce, to innovate, to make life better. Now, we might stop here and ask, well, did these guys really make life better, or did they make life more complicated? I'm on the side they didn't. Well, I know they made my life better, but they also made it more complicated. More productive. Okay, just an example. When I came on staff, we built the church with pods. You know, we had more staff then. We had a secretary, and we had three guys with the secretary. But with Microsoft, with computers and printers and spell checkers, grammar checkers, the secretary was gone, and everybody did their own work. That's innovation. We saved the salary of a secretary. All right, and to duplicate that, we have we have probably one or two secretaries does everything now. I mean, it's largely because of computers. I'm just showing you one little thing. All right? So these other things you might say, well, I'm not sure that Amazon is a good innovation for America because it puts a small guy out of business. Well, that's true. We're in an adjustment stage. But over for productivity and ease of access, if I could pick up my phone and go to my computer, order a book, and I have it in 2 days, you know, and free shipping, that's good. That's good. Now, I don't know about the mom and pop store over here. That's maybe not bad, but we got to adjust, all right? So that's all part of this whole problem. So innovate to make life better, more productive. But so far, as I know, none of these are saved individuals, yet they work out of a Christian base or are benefited from a Christian base. Because Steve Jobs' ideas, his intellectual property is protected by law because it's private property, part of Christianity, and protected by law so that no one else could take it. But what they did could only have been done in Christian America. All right. Here's a question at this point. I want to stop there. I want you to see the distinction when I say Christian America that you don't right away say, well, they're not saved. I know that. But they're still Christian in the sense that they're doing the things that are Christian. And say, well, how do I test that? Well, go to a place where there's not any Christian influence. You see how people live differently. Go to the East. Go to Japan. Well, again, a lot of Christian influence over the years has brought Christian influence there. Even China, same thing. But you got to go back before the Christian influence started to change there. We're having people living in caves. And I always think the best place to look is in the Middle East, where the same stock of Abraham lived in tents, lived in caves. And they'll still be doing that. You see, but why did these guys, the same stock, break out of this and start to innovate? Well, because of the Christianity, Judeo-Christian base to it. Now, with that said, this now just pushes all kinds of pressure into the West as to why that group innovated. Why did those guys that I mentioned, they're all out of America. Why didn't one of those guys come out of Indonesia? South Africa. Well, South Africa could have been a place, a little more freedom there, but why not? But they're copying. Believe me, I know what they're copying, because when they had little Ryko sets, you call it little lettering sets when I was in college, you didn't have computers, you wouldn't have a nice letter drawing, you'd use a Ryko set with a template for the letters, you scribed them with ink, and we bought those, and then we found out they're made in Japan, they were pieces of junk. Looked exactly like the real thing. Now, they've done it, but so you see, now other world learns from who? That's right. And who is us? We're the cars that don't break down. We're us. So we can do better than this. There should be progress. You know, I had bought a 1971 Oldsmobile, and every time I took it back to the dealer to fix it, he'd break something else that I'd have to take back again. I mean, now when I bought my car in 1990, whatever, I don't take it back. In fact, I bought my 2009 Tahoe I never had it in for service except oil change. Never. And from 1990 to 17, how many years is that? 8 years. Never had it, never for anything. All right, so there's somebody demanding that you can do better, all right? And okay, so see, the thing that Christianity has, I'm going to say this to you, but I'll tell you now. The thing that Christianity has, it has, we in our terminology, we call it hope or progress. They use the word, Rodney Stark uses the word progress. It's hope. Hope for something better, all right? The rest of the world doesn't have a hope. They're trying to preserve the past. But only in Christianity is there something where he said, there's something better. And that comes out of Genesis 1:28. It says, don't be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. God says to Abraham, or to Adam, and that Genesis mandate still stands for us today. So if you come with a new idea, don't say to yourself, well, we don't need that. You know, God wants us to suffer. No, God does not want us to suffer. God wants us to innovate and make life better. Now, we're going to be really, really limited on how much better it can get because of what? No. Sin. Who said it? Because of sin. Right. So we're going to do this with headwind. But the mandate hasn't changed. You can have to do it with the obstacles, but you still do it. You still have that idea, you know. One of the biggest innovations to me in whole life is not the iPhone. It's a roof over my head. when it rains, I don't have to be wet. We had a lot of roof leaks when I was on staff here. We had them money to fix roofs, whatever the word is. So whenever rain come over and we'd have trouble, you know, with roof leaks. Oh, you remember how the ceilings looked the other time? I mean, it killed me. So that's why I'm kind of sensitive to roof leaks. Nothing to say about the tent we bought that leaked in our first outing. So this innovation of staying dry, and rather than running to a cave, is a Christian innovation. Because the Bedouins would just as soon run to the cave. The only reason they don't live in a cave all the time, you can't move a cave to look for water. So you got to do a tent. Now, I said 83, now that's all changed. The government now brings water to the Bedouins, and so they don't move, so they stay put, and all the junk that they have ever accumulated gets accumulated around their tent, and it looks like a junkyard. I mean, it's sad. But Christianity is the only place where there is hope of progress. And if you take the hope of progress out of the human spirit, you have killed the human spirit. That's saving Christianity. I made a distinction here. Saving Christianity, what you said, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And you described it as a relationship that's possible because of the death, burial, and resurrection. But there's an aspect of Christianity that's not included in that. Well, but everything else you do. See, your death, burial, and resurrection relationship with Christ has to do with the future. It has to do with where we're going to spend eternity. How are we going to spend it? In heaven or hell? Now, there's another good question. You know, in righteousness or unrighteousness? So Christianity is larger than our salvation. Isn't it not? Okay, but I can't quite say that because that means it was only the believers that had the effect on others. That's not true either. No, it was not. When they came over to America, when they innovated in Europe, all these people that did this wonderful stuff were not all believers, but they adopted the idea that there was a God who was superior to them, that was unique to them, that could be inquired upon, who has revealed himself. And you can know all that and not be saved. But that's Christian. That's Christian. It's not Buddhism. What Buddhism does? It recycles. There's no hope. All this stuff comes out of Hinduism, basically, in the East. It's always recycling, recycling, recycling. There's never any hope. That's right. Because it might offend their God. So you're making my point. So we just got to separate saving Christianity, which is so dear to us, from the teaching of Christ to people who aren't saved, who do what he says, doesn't save them, but it makes life better. I mean, that's the idea of the hope issue here. Because otherwise, the only ones that would ever make any progress are the born-again believers, and that just isn't true. In fact, we see the unborn-again believers probably make more progress than the born-again ones do. I'm just listing, you know, Jobs and those guys. You know, I don't think they're saved. I don't know anything really particularly about them. It didn't look like it. But they're the ones that are the great innovators of our day. They're not Christians. But they're doing the things that Christianity allows. One of them is the freedom to do it, the protection of it. That's all Christian. So they live in a Christian, you know, bowl, so to speak, without being Christians themselves. So I'd say Christians, they're not that. I think everyone is born with a conscience, and that is kind of what this underlies this. You know, I didn't do my lesson there. But there's underlying this idea that, you know, built in every heart, you know, you can't escape God. You can't escape God. Which God are we can't escape? Buddha? No, it's the God of creation you can't escape. So I see there's a unity with everything. You know, the conscience motivation is one thing. What the Bible said about what we should do is the same thing. There's no contradiction here. So what this does now just allows all kinds of stuff to open up in our thinking. So let's do a little bit as we go through. Let's see how far I get. I'll skip this front part here. Last week, this a little bit. Some of this will be recovering, but you need that because I know. All right. Last week we looked at an issue that was a bit puzzling. When visiting the great cathedrals of Europe, we cannot but ask, why were they built? And why were they maintained at an enormous cost and still, in a sense, being maintained at enormous cost? Now you say, well, for tourism. Well, maybe. Why did the artisans adorn these wonders with great art representing pagan truth? Some cases, yes, but not essentially. Or first, they always reveal biblical truth, biblical stories, biblical accounts, and in some way try to represent deity. There's nothing like it in the whole world. And when the Maya Indians build one temple, we think what wonderful thing they did, or two, whatever the hummer they are, but nothing like it what you see in Europe. We don't see it in America, but we see it in Europe. The cathedrals, the churches are always in the center of focus of every time, place, town, place in the center of the at the high point for all to see. It made a statement. Why? Why did they think that was necessary? The church was the first significant community building. Why? In our short treatise last week, we said that only in Christianity is God consequential enough to demand an inquiry, that is a rational thought. And by the way, that is the gift of God given us to think. Thus, in some way, attempt to represent his works and to some extent, ultimately, even his very being. Now, that's pretty hard to do. How do you represent God in art? I can't even do a good job of heaven, which is not really very good, whatever. This urge is not imagined, but is built so indelibly into the minds of men that even sin has not or cannot erase it. It's in the heart of man to do the right thing. Paul says even the Gentiles do the things that are not prescribed in the law. Even in his fallen state, man still has a profound sense of the eminence of largeness and the total otherness of the divine. And by the way, that's the only thing that inspires. You're going to build something big for somebody that's below you? You build something big because it's above you. Now, I know there's all kinds of perversion that goes with that. I'm talking about the motivation to do this. In the West, it's Christianity. Not Buddha, not Hinduism, and not even Islam, which makes kind of its own bird. Now, with the evangelization of the West, now get this, from the time of the Apostle Paul, remember the Macedonian call, Acts 9:69, Christianity entered the Western world. Not to be scoffed. We have a whole book addressed to the Romans in the Western world. The most concise treatment of doctrine in the Bible is given to the Western world in the book of Romans. There is no doubt that Christianity spread to the world through the apostles, but to our day, there remains a witness in the West, perhaps moved to America in the 19th century. Still the West. The next proposition may need some improvement, I'm saying here, but in the United States, let's say 1900, the evangelicals did not follow Europe. Now we're going to get into this stuff. United States fundamentalists rejected European everything. But in the United States, on the evangelicals did not follow Europe, considering the right thing, it was considered the right thing to do because of the corruption in Europe, which is true. In fact, since Europe had apostatized from salvation truths, it was considered the den of iniquity and not to be regarded at all. To cope with that reality, the Americans bifurcated their world. They cast off the world as too full of pain and evil to be retained rather than looked at the next world. Rather, they looked at the next world full of righteousness and joy. So now here's where the confusing thing is for me. We have two things going on here. We have on one side the Hellenization of Christianity, which means that the material world is to be cast off. And our songs, I talked to my daughter yesterday about a song from Bible school that she remembered. I don't know whether they sang it or not, but said, "Goodbye, world, we're going somewhere else where there's glory." Well, that's not quite right, you know. But that's what that is. Goodbye to the world, we're off to heaven, you know, which is another place. You've been in my class long enough, you know, that the kingdom is heaven. That's where we're going. That's where the Bible says we're going to go. And where it's going to be perfect. Whatever you wanted, you know, perfect, that's going to be there. Not in some place where you got to bring a book or else you'll be bored. No. All right, so you have that going on. You have this Hellenization. Then we have on this other side the covenantal thing, which I'll get into in a minute here. So we have the idea we've cast off the world, the material world, and we're going to live in the spiritual world. And Europe was part of the material world. We just cast it off. Now, I understand the bad stuff has come out of Europe as the good stuff has come out of Europe. You know, all the stuff that Karl Barth, you go back to Schleiermacher and the German rationalism, all that kind of stuff that came out of Europe. And so we have a tendency, I think, evangelical early fundamentalists threw that all out, and I'm agreeing that they should have. The theology was terrible. But I'm looking at the underlying cause. Why did they build these cathedrals? Why did they build this art? Why does civilization develop? We haven't talked anything about the economy. The capitalism came out of Christianity, that you could actually invest and own and produce and make and improve your life. That's a Christian concept. So I think I'm arguing for the integrated, coordinated, unified world of God's creation. We're not two things. This is the world and this is where we're going. No, it's one thing. Now, it's damaged. It's damaged goods, but God will not throw it away. He will fix it. He will redeem it. He will restore it. He will regenerate it. Those are all Bible words for this world. I want to stick with that. Now, venturing out on a limb, which I never do, I believe that Christianity, even the good kind, has adopted an H. You're supposed to put an N in front of H, but it doesn't sound right to me. It should be A, but is that right?
It's right.
It is right. My mouth doesn't want to do that, though. And Hellenized and covenantal version, I got that messed up. So forget the grammar, and I'll read it again. I believe that Christianity, even the good kind, has adopted an Hellenized and covenantal version of Christianity. And I think we are victims of those two big mistakes. And they're up on the board. I saw two bad influences in Christianity. Hellenization of Christianity and a covenantal view of Christianity. Both are bad. Now, how does this go? Well, the covenantal part is that the only interest God has in his creation is to save the elect. Okay, that's what I did here. So we got past is marked out, future is marked out. All that's left is our salvation. And the argument goes like this. What else is more important than your own personal salvation? And the answer is, duh. Well, a lot of things, frankly. God's glory is for one thing, all right? So the covenantal part is that the only interest God has in his creation is to save the elect. This is where the glory shines, they say. The rest, according to all human history, ought to be abandoned as damaged goods. We're kind of on that side. The earth is going to be thrown away anyway. Why worry about it? Who cares how we got here? The only concern of God is now to save, covenantal thought. There is little interest in our origins or the future except that God will sort out the righteous, take them home to heaven. There we go. Far from the earth in every respect, and destroy the earth. This leaves us with the earth and its detailed history of no consequence. And we get this in our songs. Thus we have Hellenized, a dualistic view of creation. Matter is evil, spirit is good. God is only interested in saving. We should have no interest other than Jesus, the good quote. The effort to understand the bigger picture, the glory of God in all its details, is discarded and largely ridiculed. Ridiculed because it has nothing to do with our salvation. I think it's wrong. Now, I do not like to quote people I don't agree with. Now, I do that all the time. But here's one I don't agree with. But on this particular point, the guy's right dead on. And it's N.T. Wright. And if you know anything about him, he is really wild on Paul and low view of scriptures and probably gets into the issue of salvation. But on this point, he makes the right one. I just had to say his name because I know I didn't make it up. It's from a paper written by a lady that was doing a master's thesis, and the name of it is on top of the page here. So in this paper, she quotes this person, this N.T. Wright, which, again, he's not a white hat. He's a black hat guy in cowboy talk. The Western tradition, Catholic, Protestant, Evangelical, Liberal, Charismatic, Social Gospel, has managed for the many centuries to screen out the central message of the New Testament, which isn't that we are to escape the world and go to heaven, but rather that God's sovereign saving rule would come to birth on earth as it is in heaven. Do you want me to do that again? Okay. The Western tradition, whether it's Catholic, whether it's Protestant, whether evangelical, I think this gets everybody, liberal, charismatic, social gospels, have managed for many centuries to screen out the central message of the New Testament, which is the restoration of things. That's the message. Now, you might argue, well, the central message of the New Testament is our saving grace. Well, now we fall into the covenantal view. That's only God saving thing that we're worried about. No, I think God is saving the whole world. It says so in John 3:16. God so loved the whole world, and that the whole world is going to be saved on the basis of his death of his son, and that includes our salvation. So they have screened out the central message of the New Testament, which isn't that we escape to the world and go to heaven, which is my right diagram. It isn't that, but rather God's sovereign saving rule, king, would come to birth. come to reality on earth as it is in heaven, which is what Jesus prayed. What is the root of this problem? Now she goes on in her paper, where does the idea to escape this world come from? And she goes on to say it comes from Greek philosophy. I gotta look at my time. Who owns the material earth? God. Now, maybe a hard time to get over that, but it's true. It is God who created the world, and it's his. It says so in Psalm 24. I don't have the passage up there. Psalm 24:1. The earth is the Lord's and all it contains. Just for a while? No, it's his all the time. And it says that the world and those who dwell in it. Does that include us? I think so. So this leads me to think that creation is not going to be thrown away on some trash heap. God made it as with the life he instilled in Adam. God doesn't make things and, well, I guess, oh, well, forget it. No, no, no. What God does is eternal. So he gave Adam life. Will all life be annihilated? No, even in hell it will continue on. So what God touches, it stays. Contrary to the Hellenized idea to destroy the damaged material earth, with, you know, to annihilation, that's a Greek idea. So now note, if I'm a covenantalist, I've got a real hard time arguing for the future, especially if I think the world's going to be destroyed. What's the point? What's the point about talking about that all this gold is going to be destroyed anyway? So, you know, well, they're wrong about that. So that's why I say they discard the future. So I'm arguing for a coordination of all of life. All of life. We see this is our worldview. We see everything God does in one scope. Now, our salvation, don't forget, is a very important one for us personally. But in the overall scheme of things, in God's glory, it's just one of the things he's doing. So it includes all of God's works are valuable. I want to point out something that is not new, should not be controversial, but sometimes not noticed, nor given the proper place in our thinking. I believe that God's creation has a unified purpose. I don't have that up there. I've got my bifurcated and split up, you know. But he's got one purpose, one worldview. The creation and his care of it is a witness to God and thus his glory. Everything is in that creation goes to his glory. Whether it's a creation or whether it's a disposal of the wicked, all part of his glory. Glory means, in this case, the credit goes to God for his work and for his superintendence over it all. He gets the credit for it. We call it he gets his glory. But how can we think of God's work when the prince of darkness rules over the air of God's creation? That's what we usually think. Well, it can't be God's world. Look at Satan rules over it. Well, yeah. But do not abandon the creation of Satan too soon. He has been given permission to sift the earth, but the reins that control Satan are always taut, and he never steps outside his own limitations. While Satan seems to run free, he is under strict restraint, so much so that whatever happens on earth is permitted by God, and that we can say at the end of each day, it's each day sunset, then we can say God's will was done. So the integration of all life to the end of God's glory, that's, I think, a dispensational point of view. Notice, for example, the advance of art, architecture, Renaissance, the advance in art of building had advanced from the massive Romanesque arches and the lofty, magnificent ribbed arch vaults and the great wide windows opening up interior space by beautiful, tall, faceted glass windows bringing in light and airiness. But why bother? Why not live in a dark cave, rising and retiring with the sun, staying with where it is warm, where the food grows on trees, where life has not changed for generations, and I say observe the Bedouin. Why do some live as Abraham did in the migrating tents, forced to chasing their sheep and goats to where there was water? This stagnated life has gone on for centuries, even millenniums. Why do the people of the same stock break out and innovate for a better and easier, more fulfilling and productive life? What makes the difference between the West and the East? One word, Christianity. But why Christianity? One word, progress or hope. Judeo-Christian inspires progress, hope for something better. There's a future. Progress springs from our hope, Bible word. And we get our progress mandate from Genesis 1:28. I'm about done. Is there a promised future, a hope? Progress in that things will be better? Of course. I can, by the gifts of God given to me, the Christian says, make life better. The roof leaks, if it rains, build a shed. I can work to make things better until the time when the Creator will come to restore things. Work to make my life easier, better, and more productive. It's what God says I should do. Only Christianity offers hope for a better future. And we must add Judaism as part of that. What prospect of hope is there in reincarnation when there's an endless repetitive cycles awaiting the never and never to be achieved nirvana? What does Islam offer if their greatest fear is to do something that would offend Allah? Better to live in a tent than dig a well for the sheep and build a house for my family. Since I do not know, I will do the conservative thing, risk nothing, live as my ancestors did, and hope and have no hope. So the gods of polytheism cannot sustain theology because they are far too inconsequential. There are no great artistic works in the grand scale of achievement in polytheism. Christian theology necessitates an image of God as a conscious, rational, supernatural being of unlimited power and scope who cares about humans, possess moral codes and responsibilities upon them, puts responsibilities upon them. To the extent that religion inspires efforts to comprehend God's handiwork, knowledge will be forthcoming. Here we come with science. And because to comprehend something fully, it is necessary to explain it. Science arises as a handmaiden of theology. And that's precisely how those who took part in the great achievement of the 16th, 17th century saw themselves as pursuing the secrets of the creation. So as in science and with art, the artists of the Renaissance had the idea that God is consequential, that whatever it takes to explain him in art is worth all the best efforts. The scenes from the Bible are clearly legible because they read their Bibles literally and represent those accounts to the public for their instruction in their churches. No other religion has this kind of grip on the people. No other religion has a God who requires this kind of inquiry. So we hope, plan, innovate, create, and execute. Some order like that. Christians, in all its form, inspires the artistic or the creative genius like no other religion known to man. So, but from the early days, the church fathers, 2 minutes, taught that reason, that is our mind, was the supreme gift of God and the means to progressively increase their understanding of Scripture and Revelation. Consequently, Christianity was oriented to the future. That's the key. Christianity is oriented to the future. And the other major religions asserted to the superiority of the past. I'm going to stop there. I make that maybe my last one. And this future is always assumed to be on earth, okay, not in some faraway place.